Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Adesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS. I'm today joined by Martin Lambert, who's Head of Hydrogen Research at the Institute, and Abdulrahman Al-Suleiman, who's OIS Aramco Fellow. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from the paper Renewable Hydrogen Import Routes into the EU that was published by the Institute in May 2023. Welcome, both of you, to the OIS podcast series.
Thanks, David. It's great to be back.
Thanks, David. Nice to be here.
Martin, can I start with you? Now, what was the motivation for researching this topic at this time?
Well, there's been lots of talk about hydrogen imports, starting probably back with the EU hydrogen strategy in 2020. It's all about reducing carbon intensity of the economy, of course. Back in 2020, the stated target was to have 40 gigawatts of renewable hydrogen capacity in the EU and another 40 gigawatts of capacity to be imported from neighbouring regions. We said at the time we thought those targets looked pretty ambitious. For the 40 gigawatt number, that was by 2030, and the strategy had an interim 2024 target of 6 gigawatts. Now, as we sit here in mid-2023, it's looking like at best we might get to maybe 1 gigawatt by next year or so. So we think our observation about ambitious was rather justified. However, after Russia invaded Ukraine, the EU increased the target to 10 million tonnes within the EU and 10 million tonnes of imports by 2030. Just to align for the listeners on the units, that 40 gigawatt target, if you translate 10 million tonnes into gigawatts, that's around 120 gigawatts of capacity. So with that increased ambition, but falling short on the previous ambition, we thought it was important to look again at the topic of imports. And Abdulrahman has done a good job of looking at the data to see which projects are actually in the pipeline and what needs to be done to make things start to happen.
So Abdulrahman, why don't I come to you and perhaps, you know, ask a relatively basic question, you know, why import hydrogen in the first place?
The answer is centered on hydrogen being a energy carrier, not being a primary energy resource. And basically, it follows the same rules as any energy commodity. You can extract it somewhere and you use it somewhere else. So we find plenty of, in a way, traditional or fossil energy resources, in, let's say, different parts of the world. The same thing goes with, let's say, sun and wind. And hydrogen is a promising clean medium that could connect supply with demand. Simply put, for import-driven economies, hydrogen provides a clean energy carrier that can be used to increase energy security, as it can be made by countries that are rich in both renewables and also traditional, let's say, fossil fuels. For export-driven economies, hydrogen provides a path to diversify their export. It is especially relevant for countries that are rich in both renewables and traditional or fossil feedstocks, but have been entrenched in high dependence on fossil fuel rents.
Now, Martin, you know, we trade a lot of energy around the world, obviously, but what's so special about hydrogen?
Well, hydrogen's quite different. We've covered in some other papers we published that it's a lot more challenging to transport and indeed store than other energy carriers, possibly with the exception of electricity. So hydrogen's a small molecule, and it can be put in a pipeline, but it's harder to transport than natural gas. In fact, more generally, I think it's important to realise that hydrogen is not a direct replacement for natural gas. So while you can turn hydrogen into a liquid, it only becomes a liquid at minus 253 degrees C, so much colder than LNG at minus 160. So it's ever not that surprising that most hydrogen today is used very close to where it's made. Most likely, the first transport hydrogen won't be hydrogen itself. It'll be derivatives like ammonia or methanol. But the first challenge, though, is to make enough of renewable hydrogen, and then you can go on to make the derivatives.
So, Abdulrahman, let me come back to you. Now, can you provide our listeners with an update on the current situation regarding the hydrogen value chain? And also, are there any ongoing import activities?
Well, as Martin just mentioned, hydrogen is basically a captive market where it is usually produced, where it's being used, for the reason that Martin was describing. Hydrogen is not imported, but the feedstock that is being used to produce it is. As an example, most of today's hydrogen is produced through the use of natural gas as a feedstock, and this hydrogen is used for refining crude oil in many different processes, such as hydrogenation, hydrotreating, hydrocracking. So we can see that it's heavily connected and concentrated within the downstream segment of refining activities and also for ammonia production, and et cetera, so industry as well. We don't see any movement or of import hydrogen itself because it is, in a way, cheaper and easier to move the primary energy resource or feedstock, which in most cases today is natural gas.
So, Adi Rahman, are there any noteworthy projects or policy announcements focusing on the export and import of hydrogen?
This is not the first time hydrogen has come into, let's say, the spotlight. Nevertheless, this is perhaps the first time that we see it shaping up to, let's say, critical mass for both use and production of hydrogen. Following the destabilization of Europe's natural gas supplies earlier last year, the EU proposed to increase its hydrogen target from around 4 megatons, as Martin mentioned, to almost 20 by 2030, of which 10 is set to be imported. This is the biggest import target ever announced and has caused a large mobilization from resource-rich countries to announce or move ahead with export-oriented strategies for hydrogen. Well, indeed, we clearly observe the ballooning, in a way, of project announcements by or before 2030. As an example, the historical growth rate for hydrogen projects has been set at around 81 kilotons per year. Nevertheless, when we look at the period from today up to 2030, we can account for around 7,600 kilotons per year of announced project capacity, more than 90 times the historical annual growth rate, of which three quarters are based on renewable resources for producing that hydrogen. Nevertheless, these are project announcements, and it's unlikely for all these capacities to go online by 2030.
Now, Martin, coming back to you, you know, you mentioned renewable resources for producing hydrogen. And of course, we hear of the different colours of hydrogen. So why don't we use them instead of just saying renewable hydrogen?
The whole colours thing is a bit controversial in the sort of in the hydrogen industry, I think. And there's really no standardised form for talking about different types of hydrogen. I mean, the hydrogen produced is basically the same, of course. And the colours refer to the feedstocks used to make it. So in the paper, we use the term renewable hydrogen, which is typically hydrogen from electrolysis using renewable power, and sometimes called green hydrogen, because that's what the EU has really been targeting as for its main imports for 2030. Just as a slight aside, having said that, there are some signs that the EU is increasingly open to possible imports of so-called blue hydrogen. So blue hydrogen, that's from natural gas with carbon capture and storage. And I think that change is coming from increasing recognition that there's a fixed carbon budget and we need all possible solutions. So renewable hydrogen is still the preferred long-term objective, but maybe some blue hydrogen might come in the short term. But even having said renewable hydrogen, there's a bit of lack of clarity on what would qualify as renewable hydrogen. But we are making progress on that, albeit a bit slowly. So earlier this year, the European Commission proposed detailed rules about additionality, so linking renewable power and the renewable hydrogen production, to define what will count as renewable hydrogen in the EU. So there have been two delegated acts, part of the Renewable Energy Directive, and so they've now come out. They're still to be finalised, but there's more detail on that in the paper for anyone who's interested in the details.
I'd recommend, can we kind of look ahead to the period to 2030? Now, what is the likely projected scale of hydrogen production and deployment during this time frame?
As mentioned earlier, we observe a large, in a way, bubble-like growth for the next 7 years. Yet, when we only consider projects that have secured investments, we can only account up to 2026. And the annual also growth rate reduced, well, to the still impressive growth compared to historical one, of around 3,600 kilotons per year. But we can also highlight three main key points. The first one is that the large growth rate of electricity or renewable-based hydrogen production, seen when we take all announcements into account, doesn't translate into the expected projects due to come online. The second point is, when we look at announced projects alone, we might expect that renewable or hydrogen-based production would outgrow that of fossil-based production with the employment of CCUS. Nevertheless, this is not the case, at least for the next 3 years, as CCUS coupled hydrogen production is still expected to be the primary method of producing decarbonized hydrogen by 2026. And finally, also interestingly, when we consider the projects under construction and projects at FID, we can observe that the majority of these likely projects are concentrated within the EU, Canada, and Saudi Arabia, with Saudi Arabia currently having the largest renewable energy-based hydrogen production plant under construction, and in NEOM, Saudi Arabia, for which the resulting hydrogen output is intended for export.
But what about hydrogen that comes from decarbonized fossil fuels that kind of employ carbon capture, storage, and utilization? Is that a source and a way of producing clean hydrogen?
Currently, hydrogen coming from decarbonized fossil fuels is expected to be the main way of producing clean hydrogen, at least for the next few years. But the future of this type of hydrogen production is less clear compared to its sibling or, let's say, electrolyzer renewable-based production. From a cost point of view, and not to have any stranded assets, hydrogen from decarbonized fossil fuels has a logical role to play, especially in existing activities which use natural gas or coal to produce hydrogen. Moreover, if we consider free market principles and ensure complete and safe carbon storage, decarbonized fossil production of hydrogen can also play a role in meeting future market demand and contribute to increasing security of supply for future clean and decarbonized hydrogen demand.
Now, Abraham, I'm staying with you if I can, you know, going back to kind of the discussion on expected growth in hydrogen projects, let's kind of look beyond 2030. You know, do we anticipate a similar growth trajectory post-2030 compared to pre-2030?
Well, from the analysis, the answer in a way simply could be stated as no, which might raise a few investor eyebrows, but this is not as bad as it may initially sound. To elaborate, the market is currently at a very early stage, and the biggest target is the EU one, which is concentrated around 2030. So it's logical to think that most project announcements will be centered around a timeline by or before 2030. Moreover, we still do not have many long-term contracts in the future hydrogen pipeline. The EU has the biggest target, but it will not be the biggest user when the East starts taking interest in decarbonized hydrogen use. This, coupled with the eventual inking of long-term contracts in the few coming years, will likely ensure a more stable growth trajectory beyond 2030 and for years to come.
I think maybe if I can just add something there as well on that point. I mean, it just strikes me that I think looking at the projects sort of currently being planned, any project developer would always focus on sort of the early stage. So it's not really a surprise that up to 2030 is where the focus is. Because if you're a developer, you're not going to say, oh, I'm developing this project, I plan to bring it on stream in 2040, because no one will take you seriously. So I think it's rather hard. So the fact there's a wave now in 2030 is kind of typical in any project development. I think we saw the same in the LNG business in the past. There was a wave of people wanting to do projects in the short term, but then the longer term always kind of evolved over time. So I think hydrogen is not unusual in that sense either.
And of course, Martin, in the LNG business, that created to a certain extent the kind of peak and the trough, didn't it? And you kind of get this cyclical nature of development of these capital-intensive projects. Well, Adam Raman, let me come back to you, because going back to the discussion on the EU targets, and based on your analysis, now which countries are expected to be amongst the forerunners in delivering hydrogen to the EU?
Well, through the analysis, of the available literature from the EU, we identify regions that are home to more than 70 countries. Nevertheless, we identified 14 countries, from which we highlight Australia, Chile, Morocco, Oman, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE to be some of the first possible economies to deliver hydrogen to EU shores. Also, if you had given an honourable mention, Canada would also be mentioned.
So, Abdurrahman, what recommendations can therefore be made to facilitate the unlocking of EU hydrogen trade investments and also the development of value chains with future trade partner countries?
We highlight infrastructure, joint scenario building, technology cooperation, standardization, investments and finance frameworks, market development, and trading platforms, as well as education and training, and the creation of coordination hubs. Each deserves, in a way, its own research paper, but more importantly, for hydrogen trade to be unlocked, establishing and increasing the dialogue between the demand centers and the production centers will be the cornerstone for successful future hydrogen trade.
I think maybe if I can just add something on that one too. I think we're looking at this sort of building business cases for hydrogen. And really we see that for an investor, the important thing is confidence in the future revenue stream. And as Abdurrahman said, that requires users and producers to get together. Also, governments are part of that as well. So it's like a three-way dialogue between off-takers, producers, investors, and governments that they all need to come together. And once there's some clarity there, then there's probably a business case for investment. But getting all that to line up is quite a major challenge, I think.
Yeah, indeed, going back to your example earlier on of the development of the early stages of the LNG business, the deals were government to government because of the need for the buyer government to have security of supply and indeed the seller government to have security of offtake.
Indeed, yeah, we're thinking there's some combination of LNG and offshore wind are probably the best precedents of the sort of things that need to come together to make the projects work for hydrogen.
Well, Martin, would I kind of stay with you and ask you if we can kind of close off by putting today's discussion into the context of future research, which you're planning as part of the OIS Hydrogen Research. Can you perhaps tell our listeners a little about what you're doing and what we can expect in the future?
Well, as I just said, our overarching theme is around building a business case for hydrogen. And that really means looking along the entire supply chain. And we've made the observation generally that things are not progressing as fast as some of the targets. So we talked about the EU targets. And if you look at some global forecasts, they have very bullish expectations of the growth of hydrogen. So we make the observation that things are not happening as fast as people would like, but on its own, that observation is not very helpful, although to some extent, being realistic is perhaps useful, because otherwise people make plans assuming that the ambitious targets go ahead. So we are looking in some detail at those commercial structures that will be required to justify the investments that are required to set up the supply chains. And that involves looking at both the production end, the infrastructure in the middle. So we've done some work on storage already. We need to do some more work looking at that too, I think. And we produced a paper earlier this year about financing an ammonia export project. At the other end of the supply chain, we're looking at how you could finance a green steel plant, for example, and then the two need to come together to give a robust supply chain. But as I alluded to earlier, the key questions really revolve around how to give investors the confidence in future cash flows while the government still needs to be providing policy support. And there's no guarantee that need for policy support will disappear anytime soon. So people look at wind and solar and say, oh, your government support for a few years, that's what we need, then costs come down. And that's been good for wind and solar, but hydrogen may require government support for longer. The other observation too, I think, is it will depend on individual supply chains. So it may look different for power generation or for a fertilizer or for green steel. And so we'll be looking at each of those supply chains in more detail and we'll be in future papers and then also in future podcasts too, I expect.
Well, Martin Abdulrahman, thank you very much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation. It builds on the messages from Abdulrahman's paper, Renewable Hydrogen Import Routes into the EU, that was published by the Institute in May 2023. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org. Thank you.